Chapter 35. It was the morning of the 19th of March, another spring day dawning in the northern hemisphere of Mars. The sky as clean and pink as bottled plasma. Soya had driven Sunday and Jitendra back to Vishniak, traversing the Evolvarium at night in a tiny four-wheeled buggy with a bubble-top pressure cabin. They had come out of the aggregate's belly, down a steel ramp, which had folded back into the machine as soon as their wheels touched dirt. Jonathan had said that the journey was safe, that the other machines would keep their distance. None of them wished to provoke the aggregate. But Sunday nonetheless sensed a constant, low-level tension in Soya, as they bounced and yawed across the endless high plains of the Tharsis Bulge. Now and then she'd bite her lower lip, clench her knuckles on the controls, glance nervously at the radar and sonar devices, or scan the horizon for the auroral flashes which signaled the death struggles of lesser machines. They had crossed the transponder boundary and put many kilometers between themselves and the technical limit of the Evolvarium before Soya allowed herself to relax. Even then, it was a twitching, high-strung sort of relaxation. She might be free of the machines, but Soya still wished to keep a low profile. They had only been away from Vishniak for 2 full days, yet it felt like weeks to Sunday. And the little settlement, skewered by its railway line, so dismal and unprepossessing on her arrival, now looked magnificent. Soya parked the buggy in the same underground garage where Gribelin had kept his truck. "I should be going," she said, while Jitendra and Sunday grabbed their things. "Got jobs to do for my father." "At least let us buy you a coffee," Sunday said. Soya resisted, but Sunday pushed. And at last, they were riding the elevator back up to the public levels. In the elevator's unforgiving light, Soya looked older than before. Sunday began to appreciate the toll that her shadowy existence had enacted upon this woman. Then she caught her own reflection, and it was scarcely an improvement. Their genes were not so very different, she supposed. Both of them looked like they could use a few days off. They found the same cafeteria where Gribelin had been waiting for them. While Jitendra was ordering drinks at the bar, Sunday held Soya's hand. "I'm glad we got this chance to meet. Nothing's going to be the same now. I'll always know that you're out here." "I suppose we're cousins," Soya said. "Something like that. Whatever we are, I'm happy there's someone out here I didn't know about. Not just because you're a direct connection to my grandfather, although that's part of it, but just because..." Sunday faltered. "I think we could both use more friends, couldn't we? And I meant what I said about coming back here. I will." Although that might be easier said than done, she thought. It wasn't as if she could count on the pans for her expenses anymore, was it? "I would like to travel. There are problems with that, though. My past is a fiction. It's good enough to let me move around Mars, but I could never leave this planet." "What's the worst that could happen? They'd find out who you really are? I can't see that you've done anything wrong, Soya, other than maintain a falsehood to protect Jonathan. And who wouldn't do that? He seems like a good man. If the world finds out who I am, then it will discover what happened to him," Soya said. "Maybe it's time. There's no rule that says he has to hide away for the rest of his days, is there?" "I think he likes it better this way. Dropping out of history like a deleted chapter." "Fair enough. That's his choice. But you don't have to sacrifice your whole life to serve him, do you? You've already done more than enough." "I'm not that old," Soya said. "There's still a lot of time ahead." And she clearly meant a lot of time without her father, which was equally true, though Sunday had been careful not to voice that fact herself. "Like I said, I'm glad we met." Soya appeared to come to some private decision. She reached around her neck, undid a hidden fastening, and lifted away one of the wooden charms. "This is yours now, Sunday. My father gave it to me. It used to belong to Eunice. It was a gift from her mother, Soya. Soya told her it was old even then. I think it goes back a long way." "I can't." "You will." Soya peeled apart Sunday's fingers and forced the charm into her palm. "You have no say in this. No one ever does." Sunday stared down at the gift. Fastened onto a simple leather strand was a circular talisman, enclosing a more complex form that had been engraved and stained with fine geometric patterning. She allowed her fingers to curl around it, imagining her grandmother echoing the gesture, and Eunice's mother before her, a lineage of closing hands bound in this moment as if time itself was membrane thin, easily breached. "Thank you," she said softly. Jitendra was coming back with a tray and three steaming mugs of coffee. Sunday was debating whether or not to show him the gift, wondering if it ought to remain a secret between her and Soya, when without warning a proxy arrived and took his seat. It was not a golem, this was a purely mechanical-looking thing, shaped like an improbably skinny suit of armor, all silvers and chromes and burnished blues. It had a minimalist face, a slit of a mouth, two round eyes like double craters. "We need to talk," the proxy said. Sunday slipped the talisman into her pocket for safekeeping. She recognized the voice, but requested an org tag just to be on the safe side. "Lucas," she said, with icy politeness. "Fancy seeing you here. The last thing I remember is my boot crushing your face. Didn't you get the message?" "Shut up." Sunday had had enough of this crap. She braced herself and kicked out at the proxy, landing her heel in the middle of its abdomen. She pushed hard, toppling the proxy back. It went crashing, taking the table with it as its own foot flicked up. The spent drinks containers left on the table by the previous customers went flying. From across the concourse, faces swiveled towards the commotion like a bank of radar dishes. Jitendra had frozen, the tray still in his hand. "We're long past the point of reasoned debate, Lucas. Don't you get it yet? It's over. Finished. The pan screwed me. I came all this way for no—" "Shut up!" The proxy was getting back up, disentangling itself from the chair. "Just shut up. Everything's changed now." There was something too calm about the way it was telling her to shut up, more in resignation than in anger. "How?" she asked. The proxy placed the seat back upright, leaving the table tipped over. "It's about your brother. I think you should listen." She wasn't talking to Lucas, she reminded herself. Lucas was another world away. This was just an emulation, cleverer and quicker than the simulation of Eunice running in the helmet, but no closer to true sentience. Yet for all that, the illusion was compelling. The urgency in its voice was all too real. "Why do you care about Jeffrey?" Jitendra had put the drinks down on the next clear table and was busy writing the tipped over one, picking up the self-healing glassware and setting it down out of harm's way. The coffee dregs were being sucked into the floor before they had a chance to stick to anyone's shoes. "As a rule, not much. But I do care about my brother. Hector got into trouble. Jeffrey..." The proxy tilted its head downwards. "Jeffrey tried to help him. Now they're both in difficulty." Sunday could have sworn she had exhausted her capacity to feel anxious after everything that had happened in the Evolvarium. But the proxy's words still managed to touch something raw. "What do you mean?" There was that not quite human pause while the proxy formulated its response. "Hector tried to gain entry into the Winter Palace. Jeffrey went in after him only a few minutes later. Something happened shortly afterwards. The Winter Palace is gone." Sunday wasn't sure if she'd understood correctly. "Gone?" "It destroyed itself, but Hector and Jeffrey are alive, for the moment. They're on a ship together with Jumai Lule."
"I don't believe it. My brother wouldn't work with Hector. This is some kind of trick to lull me into trusting you."
"You don't have to take my word for it. Consult the Org. The news has gone system-wide."
Sunday doubted that the proxy would call her bluff that readily. So perhaps it was true after all.
"I need to talk to my brother."
"You can't. They're asleep and the ship is on its way to Trans-Neptunian space. It's moving very quickly, which in itself is noteworthy. We are concerned that the ship may damage itself, perhaps fatally. If it doesn't, it will reach its destination in a little over 7 weeks. In truth, we don't really understand what's going on. But the landscape has certainly changed."
"Not from where I'm sitting."
Sunday, the proxy said, leaning forwards to emphasize its point. Let us not pretend that you and I retain any great affection for each other. But my brother is on that ship, and your brother tried to help him. Shortly before he went under, Hector told me that we must reassess our position with regard to Eunice's legacy.
Are you saying you made a mistake?
We've both made mistakes. The proxy folded its skinny, mesh-muscled arms. She could see all the way through them, to the metal bones and actuators, and out the other side. You said it yourself. The pan screwed you. She'd been wondering if the proxy had the smarts to pick up on that. Evidently it did. How else was I supposed to get to Mars? Flap my wings? The question should be, how are you going to get back to Earth now that your friends have deserted you? Quicker than she could blink, the proxy's hand whipped out and touched her wrist. Contact was made for only a fraction of a second. She felt the implication of a touch, not the touch itself, and then broken. Then the icon popped into her visual field. I doubt the Pans will honor their obligation to return you home, the proxy explained. In any case, the next Swift ship with an available slot isn't due to break orbit for another week. But who needs commercial liners when you have Echinia space at your disposal? She felt violated. Had the proxy asked her permission to establish a body-to-body link, she would have refused it. Perhaps that was the point. What did you just give me? Authorization to sequester an Echinia Deep System vehicle, currently in Martian orbit. It's a freighter, so don't expect the height of luxury, but it can get you home in 5 weeks if you leave for the elevator today. You'll be back around Earth before Jeffrey and Hector reach their destination.
Maybe I don't want to go home. Maybe I want to follow my brother.
He's headed beyond the orbit of Neptune someday. From that far out, the difference between being on Earth or Mars is nothing. Besides, even our fastest ship would take more than 8 months to get there. The proxy let that sink in before continuing. You can't do anything for Jeffrey here, nor can I for Hector. That's why I'm still in Africa. And we all have to come home eventually.
I've only just got to Mars.
Mars isn't going anywhere, the proxy said. It'll still be here waiting for you. So she went home. Vishniak to Herschel, Herschel to the elevator. As the thread rider took her higher, she watched Mars fall away under her feet, receding and paling like some memory of a dream that began to perish at the touch of daylight. Considered in those terms, it had been a strange one. A restless fever stalked by scuttling iron monsters and grinning, bad-smelling madmen. She had nearly died in it, too. But now she was sad because there seemed to be something final in this ascent, some unaccountable certainty that there would be no return.
Goodbye, Mars,
she thought.
Goodbye, cold little world of broken promises.
The planet might not be going anywhere, but there was no reason to assume that the trajectory of her life was ever going to intersect with Mars again. In orbit, she snatched only glimpses of the requisitioned freighter. Ugly as sin, all fuel tanks and radiators, with a random plaque of airtight shipping containers fixed around its skeletal chassis. Thousands of them, like blocky 3D pixels, implying a fatter shape she couldn't quite visualize. The nameless vehicle had no permanent crew, and only a tiny life-rated habitat module. They put Sunday and Jitendra asleep, before loading them, and then there was nothing. 5 weeks of oblivion, and then the grog and haze of revival. She'd felt like a god, like the center of her own personal universe when they brought her back to consciousness on Phobos. Now some switch had flipped in her skull and she felt like a piece of grit that the universe was trying very hard to expel. But that passed, gradually. And from orbit, Earth was marvelous, impossibly blue, lit up like an indigo lantern with its own interior glow. She longed to touch it, to stroke her fingers through that atmosphere, cleaving white, billowing clouds and glittering salty seas, until she felt the hard, scabbed crust beneath. She wanted to walk on Earth, breathe its ancient airs, feel the tectonic murmur of its still beating heart. To be somewhere she didn't need to rely on machines and glass and pressure seals to keep her alive, which was absurd given the amount of her life that she'd happily spent in a roofed-over cave on the moon. But Mars had done something to her.
"I can't go back to the zone," she told Jitendra. "I mean, not right now, not this moment."
"One of us has to." He was right, too. Their affairs couldn't just be left to molder. So 2 days after arrival, they separated. Jitendra returning to the moon and the de-scrutinized zone, where he would attempt to resolve any minor emergencies that had arisen since their departure, and Sunday to the elevator, and to Libreville, and to Africa. It was bad saying goodbye to Jitendra. It might be many weeks, even months, before they were properly reunited, and Sunday doubted that Ching was going to offer much in the way of consolation while they were apart. But she had to do this, and Jitendra understood. She had not walked under terrestrial gravity for years, and the transition was far harder than she had anticipated. Medicine helped, and so did an exo. She did not feel in the least bit conspicuous wearing it, since her predicament was hardly a rare one. But what she had not counted on was the near-permanent ache in her bones and muscles, or the constant fear of tripping, of damaging herself. The ever-vigilant exo would not permit injury, and the ache was only a consequence of her body reconfiguring itself for locomotion on Earth. But neither of these realizations helped in the slightest. She still felt awkward, top-heavy, fragile as porcelain. But that passed too, or at least became no more than a tolerable background nuisance. She did not return to the household directly, for she was not yet ready to deal with Lucas. Instead, she traveled, tapping funds that were effectively inexhaustible. Libreville to the Brazzaville-Kinshasa sprawl, where there were friends and fellow artists she'd once collaborated with. BK to Luanda, where she spent long hours losing herself in the surge and retreat of the ocean, its mindless assault on the mighty Cho sea walls. She never had much trouble finding somewhere to stay, company to pass the evenings. Her friends wanted to know what had happened on Mars, why she had been all that way only to come home again. As politely as she could, she rebuffed their questions. Most of her friends were wise enough not to push. But they wanted to know about Jeffrey, and she could hardly blame them for that. Unlike the death of her grandmother, this wasn't some 7-day wander. Winter Queen, or whatever name that ship merited, had defied expectations by not destroying itself. It was still out there, further from the sun than it had any right to be, given the mere weeks that it had been underway. It had long since stopped accelerating, but it would need to decelerate if it was to rendezvous with its presumed destination. The ship's exhaust would be directed away from Earth when that happened, much harder to detect from the inner system. But countless eyes would be straining for a glimpse of those improbable energies, trying to tease out a hint at the unexpected physics underpinning them. Some of the minds behind those eyes, undoubtedly, would be half hoping for the ship to wipe itself out in a single, information-rich flash, all the better for unraveling. In fact, she wasn't worried about that herself. By now, she had some faith in Eunice. If the ship was capable of getting Jeffrey, Hector, and Jemai most of the way to Lionheart, it wasn't going to screw up the last part of the journey. But she was more concerned about what would happen to the three of them when they arrived. What waited for them out there? If the ship used up all its fuel getting to the asteroid, could they get back home again, or survive long enough to await rescue? But again, she fell back on that faith. This was engineered, part of a plan concocted by Eunice more than 60 years earlier. There had to be a point to it, beyond an elaborate form of punishment aimed at her descendants. So she hoped, anyway. Meanwhile, Jeffrey was not in Africa. When he left Earth, it had not been under ideal circumstances, and he could not have known how long it would take to break into the Winter Palace and ferret out its secrets. But he had surely not counted on being away for months. Since he had been involved with the Amboseli elephants, Sunday knew, Geoffrey had very rarely been away from them for more than a couple of weeks at a time. A month would have been exceptional. He'd often told her how much effort he had invested in establishing a rapport with the study group, and how easily that rapport could be undermined. That, fundamentally, was what had brought her back to Africa, although she had not been quite ready to admit it to herself at first. The elephants had never meant much to her, even though she had shared very similar childhood experiences with Geoffrey. But if she had been pulled away from the moon unexpectedly, and if something she had nurtured was in danger of suffering through neglect, she had no doubt that Geoffrey would have been there for her. In Luanda, her funds provided an AirPod. Still awkward in the exo, she folded herself into its interior and told it to fly to the Amboseli Basin. She would be within a stone's throw of the household, but the household could wait. In the air, east of the Great Rift Valley, the AirPod on autopilot, she chinged Gleb Ozerov. She hadn't bothered working out what time it was in the de-scrutinized zone. The zookeepers kept weird hours anyway, and after what she'd been through on Mars, she was of the distinct opinion that they could damn well take her call. Sunday had requested outbound Ching, and after a moment of hiatus, the bind inserted her bodiless presence into the menagerie. Gleb, who must have accepted the inbound call, stood next to a table-sized trolley, collecting leaf samples from the vivariums.
"It's good to hear from you," he said, doubtfully,
as if there had to be a catch somewhere.
"I was hoping you'd get in touch."
He put down his tools, dusted his fingers on his laboratory smock.
"I tried reaching you, but you are still on the ship. Are you all right?"
Sunday was already answering before Gleb had finished his piece.
"How much do you know about what happened on Mars?"
It wasn't just time lag that delayed his answer.
"I was hoping to hear your side of the story before making my mind up. Chama's been trying to find out what he can, but he's still under lockdown, which complicates things." "You screwed us. Your people, Gleb. The ones I thought I could trust." "My people?"
He sounded stung by this, as if what she'd said was somehow beneath her, as if she had failed to live up to his hitherto unblemished image of her.
"Truro, Holroyd, whoever, I don't give a fuck. I was lied to, told I'd be helped, when all they wanted was to get to the box before me. Jitendra and I nearly died out there, Gleb. The Evolvarium nearly ate us alive. And that wouldn't have happened if we'd got in and out without being betrayed. Gribelin died out there."
Gleb selected another tool and nipped a leaf sample. He held the wispy green sliver up to his eyes for inspection, frowning slightly.
"Nobody comes out of this looking good, Sunday. But if it's any consolation, Chama and I had nothing to do with what happened on Mars. When Chama put his neck on the line in Pythagoras, he was doing you a favor. To buy a favor back from my brother." "Perhaps. But beyond that, he had no ulterior motives."
Gleb placed the nipped-off leaf sample into one of his specimen boxes, clipping shut the airtight lid.
"Arethusa contacted us, it might interest you to hear, not long after that unpleasantness on Mars. I've no reason to trust her either." "Trust who you like, Sunday. I'm not here to make up your mind for you. She spoke about Truro, though. She said things were possibly going to become difficult for Chama and me since our sponsorship was so closely tied to Truro and his allies."
He paused to drag a stylus from behind his ear, using it to scribe a note on the specimen box.
"Arethusa said things were going to become difficult for her, too. It seems this whole sorry business has precipitated a bit of a rift. I thought Arethusa was in charge. So did she.
So did we.
But it appears that there are elements who feel she's not been promoting the panspermium ideology with sufficient vigor, at least in recent years. My brother and I had our theories about Arethusa. If we're right, then there wouldn't be a panspermian ideology without her."
Sunday hesitated on the threshold of what she hardly dared say, because it felt almost blasphemous to voice such speculation in Gleb's presence. But the time for tact, she decided, was long past.
"I think I met Lin Wei, your founder. I think she's still alive. I think all of you owe Arethusa more than you realize.
Gleb nodded slowly.
I won't say the possibility had never occurred to us, given your family's connection to Lin Wei.
She was at Eunice's scattering. Arethusa was behind the proxy, of course. And she could only have chosen the form she did, because she half wanted one of us to make the connection.
Gleb wheeled the trolley to the next vivarium.
She still has influence, still has allies. For the time being, I'm fairly hopeful that she can still protect Chama and me, even ensure the continuation of basic funds and amenities. But that isn't guaranteed, and right now we need all the friends we can find.
Actually, screw us, we don't matter at all, but the dwarves do. This collaboration is vital, Sunday. We can't let it fall apart just because of a squabble between Arethusa and her rivals.
Funnily enough, it's the elephants I'm calling about.
For the first time since she had chinged in, Gleb smiled.
Yours or mine? I should say the dwarves or the Amboseli herd?
Both, ultimately. Right now, I need help with the big ones. You know about my brother's situation, I take it.
Difficult not to. I hope things work out Sunday. Our thoughts are with Jeffrey.
Hastily, he added,
and the other two, your cousin and the woman.
Hector and Jemai. Yes, we're concerned about them all. But there's nothing we can do for them, and there is something we can do for the elephants. Jeffrey wasn't expecting to be away this long, and I'm worried about the herd. That's why I'm back in Africa. I feel I should be doing something.
They are fundamentally elephants, Gleb said thoughtfully. They've been managing on their own for millions of years. It would be presumptuous to assume that they can't do without us for a little longer.
But they're elephants with machines in their heads. Elephants my brother has been interacting with for most of his adult life. They're used to him coming and going, studying them. He speaks to them for pity's sake. I don't know what his not being there is going to do to them. And that's before I start worrying about medical issues or pregnancies or anything else going on with the herd. My brother would have known what to do. I don't.
Did he leave specific instructions?
She thought back to the message Jeffrey had recorded before entering cryosleep.
Nothing too detailed. I don't think he wanted to burden me, and anyway, he had enough on his mind back then.
If there was anything vital, he'd have told you.
She nodded, wanting to believe it. But Gleb sounded much surer than Sunday would have been.
All the same, our hands aren't completely tied. Your ching tag places you very near the herd.
On my way to it right now.
Chama and I know our way around the M group. Remember that we've been taking an interest in Jeffrey's work for years. We know the hierarchies, the bloodlines, and I can probably identify 24 individuals by sight alone, even though I've never been to Africa. You've never had much contact with them, have you?
It felt like an admission of weakness, a duty she had shirked.
Virtually none.
In which case we won't risk direct contact. Leave that to your brother for when he gets home. But we can at least monitor the M group and any other parties that take our interest. And, not inconsequentially, maintain enough of a presence to deter any researchers who feel like claim jumping. Although I hope no one would be that irresponsible, given the very public reasons for your brother's absence.
I hope not.
But human nature being what it is, we'd best take no chances. Will you be maintaining a physical presence in the area?
For the time being.
Which meant, until she had news from Jeffrey, good or bad, however long that took.
Chama had best not risk involvement, at least until his 100-day lockdown expires, and there's no reason for me to be there in person. But I can give you as much support as you need for as long as you want it. That's my promise, Sunday. If you feel we've wronged you, then I aim to do my small part in rectifying that. I may not succeed, but I'm prepared to give it a damn good try.
Thank you,
she said. And it was a heartfelt thanks. Although it was only in this moment that she realized how much she had been counting on his help.
The AirPods console chimed, pulling her back into its sensorium. She was nearing home.